We've now made our way to 2 Samuel. And as I noted before, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel were originally one book in the Hebrew canon. In fact, they still are one book in the Hebrew canon. But we have divided them in our Christian arrangement of the Bible when the Bible was translated from Hebrew into Greek. And so our themes for 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel really should be quite similar, or should be part one, part two. You have to think of these books as part one, part two, really. So what was our key word for 1 Samuel? Do you remember? It was the word... You guys have blank looks on your faces. It was transition. It was transition from what? From theocracy to monarchy. Now, as we get into the second part of the book of Samuel, we're going to see that that monarchy actually includes a rather significant covenant. So to put the two together, our key word covenant for 2 Samuel, we have transition into covenant. It's really the idea of the book of Samuel. When I say book singular, putting the both of those together. So 2 Samuel brings in this concept of covenant. Now you say, well, we've already talked about a lot of covenant. We've talked about the Abrahamic covenant. We've talked about the Mosaic covenant. We've talked about the land covenant. Now this idea is expanding as we get into 2 Samuel, because the theme of this book is really God's covenant kindness to David. Now we see God bringing this one that was introduced to us in the middle of 1 Samuel and actually anointed to be the king of Israel. We see that God, like he chose Abraham, God chose to give his kindness to David. David was the most unlikely of all the sons of Jesse to be king in human terms. He's the youngest guy, just kind of handsome and ruddy, yes. But his father didn't even think to invite his youngest son to the family dinner when the prophet Samuel came to his home. I mean, his father himself didn't really think highly of David enough to even have him come and be there with the honored guest. But God did. God thought very highly of David. And that really tells us a whole lot more about God than it does about David. So this is undeserved, as it is for you and for me, to be recipients of the undeserved grace of God. If you go all the way through the Old Testament and you don't understand more about God's love and God's grace, I have failed you as a teacher. And you have totally missed the Old Testament. This whole idea of, oh yeah, God's really mean and really got a judgment in the Old Testament. Oh man, but then he gets really nice in the New Testament. So just bear with the Old Testament for a while. That whole concept, that is totally, totally false. You really see it from the very first verse. I mean, why did God create the heavens and the earth except from his grace and his love for all of us? He didn't have to do that. He didn't even have to make this world for us. So that all continues on with God's covenant kindness to David when we get into 2 Samuel. So what does he say specifically? We see it in the key chapter of this book, chapter 7. For when you die, we're talking to David, when you die, I will raise up one of your descendants, and I will make his kingdom strong. He's the one who built a house, a temple for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now, when Nathan said this to David, he probably had to pick him up off the floor. I'm reading between the lines, okay? Notice that last word, forever. Has there ever been a king, even in his own goal, even in his own mind, to think, that my dynasty with my son and my grandson is actually going to ever last forever. I doubt there's ever any king that's thought that far. I don't know how many generations a normal king would want to have his dynasty go, but certainly not forever. And here's where God does far more than David ever asked, far more than, you know, the Lord has done in your life far more than you've ever asked. He's probably done it many, he's done, if you thought about it, he's done 100 things for you today that you didn't even ask for. Our problem is not that God's not gracious to us. It's just that we don't really stop long enough and think about it. We do stop and thank him normally for food, but I find that more and more people seem to just kind of plow right into their food without even thanking him as well. But God's kindness to David is going to be seen in this book, and it sets a foundation for understanding Kings and Chronicles, and frankly, the rest of the Bible, all the way up to today. And so our kingdom idea here in the book here is God delegated his rule to David and his seed by covenant. So here's God's promise. All right? And he protected his dynasty despite punishing David's sin and the rivals to his throne. Chapters 11 to 24. In other words, we're going to see David fail in this book. We don't see any great failure from David in 1 Samuel, but we certainly see it here. But despite his failure, and you know what I'm talking about, his failure with Bathsheba and killing her husband Uriah, and despite these rivals to the throne, these many people who come after David and are seeking to really take the kingdom away from him, God's covenant kindness can't be thwarted. And God promised David that he would live long enough to have a son who would have a son, and there would be a temple, and it all comes about. So summing it up in our summary statement, God establishes David as king and protects his dynasty despite punishing David's sin and the rivals to the throne. To show his justice and faithfulness to fulfill his purposes through his covenant kindness shown to David and his seed. Wow, that's a long sentence, but hopefully you get the basic idea there. It's quite similar to the other one under kingdom. So this covenant idea is very, very prominent. God restored Israel's unity in the Davidic covenant that promised an eternal seed, throne, and kingdom, and was not conditioned even on David's fidelity. So what we find is that, expanding this out a little bit, we call this the United Kingdom before Solomon comes, and after Solomon, the kingdom divides. But in reality, the kingdom isn't all that united prior to David. It certainly was under Joshua. But after Joshua and the whole period of the judges came, the whole land was quite divided. And it was not divided in the north and south like we find later on in the Old Testament. It was divided by tribes. Everybody was just concerned about their tribe. And they weren't concerned about the nation as a whole. But God used David to truly unite the kingdom as a godly king, rather than uniting them under fear like his predecessor Saul. And he's a great example of leadership. He's a great example of how God, in his gracious ways, can provide the kind of leadership we need for unity. And then out of that comes the seed promise that David's seed would never be destroyed, completely destroyed. The throne promise that right to rule would stay with David's family, and it would actually be a right to rule forever. And then the kingdom would remain with David. We're talking about the southern kingdom. Even after the kings split, our, even after the nation splits into north and south, those kings in the south, they're all still part of the Davidic line. And so God himself is actually fulfilling that promise. All right? In terms of redemption, God restored Israel's unity in the Davidic covenant. It promised eternal seed, throne, and kingdom, and was not conditioned even on David's fidelity. Does that sound familiar? That's the exact same statement I just read. Because it really says much about redemption as well. In the temporal sense, I guess you could say, David is a temporal redeemer. But he certainly is a type of Jesus Christ when we get into understanding the messianic theme here. David portrays Jesus Christ as the divinely chosen king who will maintain a righteous and eternal reign. David had a righteous and temporal reign, but he was only a foretaste of Jesus who would do the same for all eternity. So we have problems when we go into the New Testament and we just read the New Testament without understanding the Old Testament context. That's how I read Matthew 1. My first time I read the book of Matthew, I was quite bored with that first chapter because I had no idea who David was and Abraham was. And I thought, they're starting off with the genealogy? That's not a very interesting way to start. And I wasn't reading it the way that a Jew certainly would read it who understands this Old Testament here. So I'm glad that we're putting Old Testament survey in the curriculum before New Testament survey, even though some of you are taking them backwards order, all right? But. So God's covenant kindness to David is what we find in this book. And it looks like I'm just crossing through this chart here, but what I'm actually trying to do with this line is I'm trying to show how life went for David. Some of you have done this and you call it your own genogram. You write kind of the high points in your life, the low points in your life. That's a good exercise because it helps you kind of to be able to think through. Let's see, was college a high point in your life or was it a low point in your life? You know. And what we find here is in the first 10 chapters, David rises quite quickly when he's over Hebron, king over Hebron in the south, over Judah. But then in chapter 5, going all the way up to chapter 10, it gets even better because he ends up being king over all Israel. And life was great for David. He kept seeing all these wonderful things that God was doing in his life all the way up through chapter 10. But his adultery was a major, major fall in his life. Chapter 11. And then it could have gone up. It wouldn't have had to go down so far. But he commits the second sin of chapter 11, and that is the murder of Uriah's husband. Bathsheba's husband, yeah. We have to be careful about those sort of things nowadays. And the murder brings him down even farther. And God says to him, I'm not going to take away my covenant kindness from your seed. I'm not going to undo this promise. But actually, part of the promise of the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7 was, I will discipline you and your sons when they sin. That was actually part of the Davidic covenant. We don't normally emphasize. He says, I'll discipline you, but he makes a contrast there. I'm jumping into the key chapter here, chapter 7. He says that the Lord will make this covenant with you and with your son, 2 Samuel 7:14. Doesn't that sound like another 7:14 that you know about? 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people, which are called by my name, shall, you know. This is a similar idea, actually, in 2 Samuel 7:14. I will be his father. He's talking about Solomon here. and he'll be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." Now, he's specifically talking about Solomon here, but the same thing applies to David. That God would also discipline David when he sinned, but he would not take his love away from David. And as we'll see when we get on into Kings, the same kinds of things that David did, the same sins actually, ends up with the same result. And I don't know if you've ever noticed, I never noticed till recently, but it's in the same chapter. Chapter 11. It's women, watch out for women in chapter 11. That's the warning David had. Now, I know they didn't have chapter divisions back then, but Solomon didn't heed it. And when we get to chapter 11 regarding Solomon, 1 Kings chapter 11, we end up, Solomon has the same problem, same chapter, and his little genogram, what do you call this little line, up and down line, his plummets quite a bit in 1 Kings as well. And he ends up bearing the price of his sin. His children do, to the point that his son ends up dividing the kingdom. And David's children do, to the point where they threaten to divide the kingdom. Actually do divide the kingdom. Because one of his sons, Absalom, initiates a rebellion against David. And here you see the wonderful balance that God has in your life and my life as well. Things go well in our lives. I don't want to be oversimplistic here, but things go so much better for us when we honor the Lord with our lives. But when we sin against Him, things plummet. And in this regard, I think of another David who's actually named after King David, who has the same problem that I learned just 2 days ago. He hit his chapter 11. A seminary professor, missionary like me, pastor, who has another woman in his life. He hit his chapter 11. And it's destroyed his missionary career. It's destroyed his opportunity to serve as a pastor. It's destroyed his opportunity to serve as a seminary professor teaching God's word. In fact, my wife and I were trying to remember, I think we were at their wedding like 35 years ago. And he's thrown it away. And his name is David, named after David. Just to let you know, 1 Samuel's still going on today. And the chapter 11s are still going on. So, men, take heed. And I'm a man too, so I'm talking to myself. Don't let your line go way down like this, and then we call it chapter 11. And in this case, today, normally it's adultery. There's not a murder that follows. Normally not. But in David's case, the murder that followed ended up showing that David was going to have actually the same sins of sexual immorality and murder in his family with his own children. And that's where this line is way down here. God's judgment, the troubles after chapter 11 relate to family. Chapters 12, 13, 14. And it's going to be the same thing when we get to 1 Kings. 12, 13, 14. It's just going to relate to Rehoboam, Solomon's son. I guess God was the one who was designing these chapter divisions, you know. but it helps us to remember when these things happen. And then the politics, chapters 14 to 20, mostly refer to the rebellion of his son, but others who are rising up against David, against his kingdom. The last part of the book, the last four chapters, chapters 21 to 24, is an appendix. And it ends mostly on a positive note because it demonstrates David's humility for three chapters. But it finally does end with a word of warning, with the pride of his senses in chapter 24. So here's where Samuel is a bit different than other books of Scripture that maybe are going to end on a really high note. Samuel ends on a low note. And sometimes that's good, isn't it? To end on a low note, because it causes us to reflect on our own lives. So the book has both the good and the bad. Huddleston calls it History of the Reign of David, and that's really pretty good. As I think about what God wants to teach us in this book, when I preach through it, I call the message "Be Kind," because we're talking about God's covenant kindness to David in this book, and certainly the Lord wants us to be like Him. We obviously need kindness in our world. Every one of us has been the brunt of jokes, or we've been rejected by others. And so the question, I think, that's raised in the book is, how does God model kindness to us so that we can be kind to others? He models it in this book. God's kindness gives us leaders. It was God in His kindness that gave the nation David. And we see this in the first 10 chapters. Like I said before, it doesn't only tell us about David, it tells us about God. How God Himself was the one who was demonstrating His kindness. The Lord grants us His divinely appointed kings in the past, and most of us are not under kings now, but he gives us leaders now to demonstrate His kindness. And then God also shows His kindness. God in His kindness gives us discipline as well. We find the rest of the book emphasizing how if God is a loving God, then God is going to be a God who will get the attention of His children that He loves. We do this with our own children. You have, hopefully, this has been the case for you, with your parents who raised you, that they gave you a measure of discipline, enough discipline to show that they loved you. I realize that parents are not always the best examples of God's love, and maybe your situation is quite different from that. But God's design in parenting is to demonstrate love partly through discipline. And so God's kindness gives us discipline. And then ultimately, David in this book pictures Jesus. Help me. How many pictures of Jesus do you see in David? How do you see this coming out? What similarities between David and Jesus do you see that will help us to see that David is actually one of the best depictions of Jesus you'll find in the Old Testament? Help me out with this. Both were shepherds. Very good. They learned how to... They're shepherds in the sense of shepherding people, yes. They both end up being kings. They were people who learned how to shepherd others, care for others, and it ends with kingship. Okay, think geography. Both from Bethlehem. And Bethlehem, by the way, means house of bread. That's literally what it means. Even though they had a lot of sheep there, it was also the breadbasket of Israel. These sheep were raised on this, on these hills for wheat and stuff. Other Carla?
Same thing. Yeah.
The line of Judah goes right in, narrows to David, and the line of David narrows right into to Jesus. So yes, they are they're in the same line. Jesus is a direct descendant of David. Not only is he a direct descendant from David, but he's a direct descendant of David through his father, Joseph, and also his mother. Joseph and Mary were both in the line of David. So he's a double direct descendant of David. Many, many similarities. They were both righteous. Jesus was completely righteous, but the assessment of David that the author gives is that David was a righteous king. Not without his faults, but we have to give credit to David for when he did fall, he turned around and he did repent. He turned from it. He turned to the Lord, and it didn't destroy him. It certainly humbled him, which was great for him as a king. I think the main idea of 2 Samuel is God will rule the world through David's descendant, Jesus. This is why we have this book. We have this book to set in order our understanding of who Christ is. What does it mean that Jesus is Christ, anointed one, Mashiach? It means the anointed king. The prototype of Jesus is actually in David. From a very humble background, there's another thing they had in common. From an obscure city, and yet God chose them to be his representatives. It leaves us with the question of, well, how do you respond to God's kindness in Jesus? First of all, I would say trust Jesus as your Savior and your coming King. They had to place their faith back in Israel that God was leading them through King David. And when they did, they certainly experienced a blessing. In fact, David was used of God to expand the territories larger than any time in history of Israel since then and now. Solomon got tribute farther up in the north, but Solomon didn't really expand the kingdom geographically significantly. But this time of David and Solomon is known as the golden age of Israel's history. For us, we need to place our trust. We need to place our faith that God knows what he's doing, and he has provided Jesus as that ultimate descendant of David. It's really accepting God's kindness to us. But then the natural response of accepting God's kindness is a want to be a conduit of God's kindness as well, wanting to demonstrate God's kindness to others. And to show God's kindness to others is to be like him. Is to recognize that because he was faithful to be kind to us, we should also be faithful to be kind to others. And that's the essence of the book. And I hope now you can see better what I was talking about before in terms of the theology of Ruth, how Ruth fits in between Judges and Samuel. I covered this before on page 193. The monarchy is needed. We see that in Judges. The monarchy is prepared in Ruth because God uses this godly couple to become the great-grandparents of David himself. And then finally in the book of Samuel, we see the monarchy established. Bethlehem improves as you go from Judges to Ruth to Samuel. It is presented in a more positive light. From a very, very negative view of Bethlehem, where the idolatry and the concubine of Judges 17 to 19 come about, to seeing how God was blessing Bethlehem in the book of Ruth under Boaz, and all the Bethlehemites who continue to say, "The Lord bless you, the Lord bless you." And God keeps answering that blessing, that prayer. And finally, David ends up becoming the ideal king that all the other kings are going to be compared to. In Samuel. The same thing happens, but in a reverse order, with Gibeah. where the murder of Judges 19 and 20 takes place, that almost destroys the entire Benjamite tribe. We see that God did spare Saul and others. Benjamites weren't destroyed. But Saul is quite a disappointment when we see Saul noted in Samuel. And you end up seeing how God's ultimate plan was really in David, not in Saul, when we get to the book of Samuel. So there's kind of how those fit together. Now, how do they all fit together? If you go to page 264, I'm on slide 30. We really don't have time to cover Chronicles, but I do want to just say a few things relating to Chronicles. Chronicles, 1 Chronicles is parallel to 2 Samuel. So in terms of the chronology of Israel's early history, if you've studied 2 Samuel, then you've got many of the basics about David. What you don't have is you don't have this great emphasis on David's preparations for the temple, the spiritual, theological aspect that is emphasized in Chronicles. And so 1 Chronicles has actually quite a few things that 2 Chronicles does not, or 2 Samuel does not have. But they both are in respect to David. By the way, these kings reigned, each of them, about 40 years. Saul, 1043, or some would say 1041, for about 40 years. David for 40 years, starting in the year 1011. And then Solomon for 40 years, starting in 971. At the end of the 40 years, at 931, that is where the kingdom ends up splitting after Solomon's reign. That's why I have the karate chop guy here, chopping the kingdom in half. And he chops it in half from to north to south. By that time, we are in 2 Chronicles, which is parallel to 1st plus 2 Kings. Now, you might say, why do we do this? Why do we have this kind of thing? Why do we have these two records? It's a similar sort of question to ask, well, why do we have four Gospels? Wouldn't one Gospel be sufficient? Evidently not. That's why God gave us four. Each one of these Gospels are written to a different audience and have different emphases. Likewise, we find the same thing for Kings and Chronicles. And they overlap in terms of the time period, but there are some notable differences that I highlight on 264. Kings, as the name implies, covers all the kings. It deals with Israel and Judah. Chronicles, as the name implies, basically chronicles the most important things you need to know, especially about Judah, almost exclusively Judah. It doesn't mention several of the kings in the northern kingdom. That's because Kings is covering the royal and prophetic elements. So you get the basic history in Kings, but then Chronicles comes about. Chronicles was written about 100 years after Kings, and it adds priestly elements that we don't find in Kings, especially on the temple and on worship. They both have a basis of how they evaluate the kings. In the book of Kings, they're based on the Mosaic Law, but in Chronicles, they're constantly referring back to David and how David worshiped and how David honored the Lord as they look at later kings and give them an assessment. The ethical purpose of Kings is judging both nations, that God was justified in actually judging them. They deserved it. Whereas the ethical, or the purpose in Chronicles, is more covenant. You see God's blessing on Judah due to David. And that's why Chronicles is much more positive. It shares a lot of the things that Kings does not mention, especially as it relates to the temple. And it leaves out many of the things that Kings and Samuel say. For example, David's sin with Bathsheba in Samuel and Kings. That 2 Samuel, that's a huge part of 2 Samuel. It doesn't even appear when you get to 1 Chronicles. It just says, when the kings go out to war, David conquered the Ammonites. It says nothing about David not actually being there. Whereas 2 Samuel says, when the kings going out, kings normally go out to war, I'm talking about 2 Samuel 7, David didn't. David stayed in Jerusalem. When the kings normally go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army, I'm reading 2 Samuel 11, they destroyed their Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. You don't have that when we get to Chronicles. Part of the problem, part of the reason for this, I guess, is that the tradition is that Jeremiah the prophet wrote Kings. Now, he also was a priest, but he had more prophetic elements in Kings here. You don't see even in the book of Jeremiah a great emphasis on him as priest, even though he was a priest. It highlights that his role as a prophet. Whereas Ezra is pretty much known only as the priest. And Ezra, as the author of Chronicles, was going to emphasize those sort of things that would have centered around Israel's worship. Man's faithlessness is contrasted with God's faithfulness. The negative rebellion tragedy outlook is contrasted in Chronicles with a positive hope amidst the apostasy. Kings written to the exilic Jews who had not come back to the land yet, but Chronicles talks about how they had come back and God had established them 100 years later. And so it goes, the chronology goes farther with Chronicles. And it's more spiritual as opposed to Kings being more political, historical. Chronicles is more spiritual, theological, emphasizing God's grace and sovereignty, whereas Kings emphasizes God's justice and human responsibility. Now, that much you can see because you guys know how to read. It's all in the chart there. But any discussion or any questions you have? Charmaine.
That middle video on this part, I have three questions. Okay, maybe you'll ask about this leadership thing first. So like, sometimes when you look at church leadership, or like, you know, so when you say that, I hear all these things thinking that, like, that God never intended for the way Israel is to be ruled by kings, right? And
well, some might say that it was never God's intention for Israel to be ruled by kings. But if you go back to Genesis 17, God promises Abraham, kings will come from you. And God's plan is monarchy, even in the future. Because he's appointed Jesus to be king, not prime minister, not president. Jesus won't be up for election. You know, God's not... we often exalt democracy in our depending on our nations, you know. The students who understand the best, the kingship idea best, in my experience, have been the ones from Thailand that I've had in class. The Thai students understand this concept a whole lot better. Don't think of monarchy as being such a bad thing. I don't think the purpose of these books is to teach us church leadership. You know, I should say that first. What we're supposed to read as we read through these is we're supposed to see how God is dealing with Israel, and we're supposed to understand mostly about how God deals with us. My point was that God does use leaders in our lives. I think that's but that makes God the focus. The way God demonstrates his grace to us is providing good leaders for us. But still, don't make the leaders the focus. That tells us about God. The subject of the Old Testament and the New Testament is God. It's not us. So I'm a bit resistant toward those who say, oh, the purpose of these books is to teach us how to be a good leader. David was a good leader, and, you know, we need to be good leaders. I don't think that's really the purpose of them. That's not to say we can't learn, we can't grow from these sort of things. But sometimes, especially in Old Testament narrative, sometimes people do things and we don't even really know whether they did the right thing. For example, speaking of David, remember when David goes to this city and he protects the sheep of a man named Nabal? By the way, the word Nabal means fool. Why he ever took that name? Who named him? Did his mother name him? I don't know. Hopefully not. Sometimes people, their names got changed because of their character, and he certainly shows himself to be a very foolish man, right? But the one who saves his neck is his beautiful, discerning wife, Abigail. But Abigail goes out from underneath her husband's authority. She doesn't say anything to her husband. She goes and she provides all these gifts, and she appeases David's anger, and David doesn't actually come and destroy the whole family. And David says, wow, you saved your life. You saved all the men's lives. He said, we were going to come and we were going to wipe out all the men, your father and your husband's household. And Abigail says, yeah, my husband's name is Nabal, fool. And he's living up to his name. I've heard that taught and preached different ways. Now, ladies, is this an example of what to do? Is this telling my wife what she's supposed to do when I'm a fool? She should be like Abigail, come around from behind my back, steal some money from the savings, or is it saying, is it Abigail not, is she a bad example? This is what you're not supposed to do. Don't be an Abigail. I can see that in the sermon title on the bulletin. Do not be an Abigail, ladies, or something like that, The way these things are sometimes preached. Actually, I don't think the text tells us what we're supposed to do or what we're not supposed to do. What we see in the text is this is what people did. And it doesn't even, I don't think, gives a real assessment of that situation. What it tells us is that David was about to act rashly, and God, I want to give God credit again, not to say that Abigail shouldn't get any credit, but God should get credit for how he works even through the failings of people. And he's the one who gets glory on all that. Carla, your thought?
So I said, I was just going to add that God was using Abigail to protect David from sinning, almost kind of like making a foolish decision and killing the house.
Mm-hmm. God did use Abigail. And God, I would say, God could have used Abigail in another way too. She could have been really honorable to her husband. Perhaps she could have talked to him and said, hey, do you realize that David and his men are coming and they're going to kill all of you? And maybe he would have said, do whatever you think's necessary, Maybe, probably not, because he was a greedy man. He didn't want to share any of his goods with anybody. But
he ended up dying, so.
Yeah, he died. He lived 10 more days. So, I don't know. But you can read all kinds of stuff into that story. Oh, Abigail killed her husband. Well, no, he lived 10 days longer because of Abigail. but God killed him. It says very clearly in the text that the Lord struck him. Lloyd?
I thought the idea that Abigail kind of usurped her husband's authority is a bit odd.
It's to say she usurped her husband's authority is what?
Maybe was watching his flock by not as being on the run. At the same time, they were helping
Nabal. Uh-huh. Nabal.
Should actually reciprocate kindness.
Yeah. Again, this is in the kindness theme.
It's already been known to him that we were helping you. Sending a very unkind message back. Abigail knows what's coming.
Yeah, my purpose in bringing up that story is not to, we as you well know, we don't have the time to go through each one of the stories. I would love to, but we don't have the time to do it. The point is, when you read a biblical narrative, ask the question: what is God doing? what am I supposed to learn about God through this narrative? Don't ask the question, let's see, should I do this or should I not do this, what this person's doing? Don't jump right to the application and look at everybody in the Bible as an example of what you're supposed to do or what you're not supposed to do. That's not to say you can't learn some things, but that's not how the scripture is to be read. Well, I'll talk more about this when we get to Nehemiah later on, because this comes to fore in Nehemiah probably more than any other book. But yeah, last word there, Charmaine. Is God getting less strict as we go through the Bible? I think of my own role as a parent. Am I less strict as a parent of sons in their 20s and 30s? I would say yes. Am I the same person? I think I'm basically the same guy. But I'm not hands-on. I mean, I didn't call my sons when I woke up this morning, hey, did you brush your teeth? I mean, my sons are... They're men. I don't need to ask whether they brush their teeth. My oldest son always had this problem of not putting his shoes on. You know, not getting his stuff together to get in the car to go to school, you know? And so he'd always put his shoes in the car. And we're all like, come on, you got to manage your time and all this sort of stuff. At one time, we're on the way to school, and it's about 1 hour drive to school, okay? From the north of Singapore all the way down to the south. We got halfway through, or maybe three quarters of the way through, and that's when he normally starts putting shoes on. And he's looking around, where's my shoes? He didn't have any shoes. And he left them there at the house and everything. Oh, can we turn around and go back? So, no, you can't make your other brothers get late for school, and your mom's a librarian. We're not turning around right now and making the whole family late because you forgot your shoes. You know? So he went that whole day without shoes at school. It ruined a pair of socks, but, you know, we could afford a pair of socks for a good lesson. But I didn't call my son this morning. Hey, did you remember your shoes before, you know, before you left the house today? And I think God is like that. I think God, when you get the New Testament, you know, there's this whole foundation. In fact, this is the imagery that's used in the book of Galatians, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Galatians says that the law was a tutor to lead us to Christ. But now we're Christ. We have all these... We actually have... there's a lot less things that God says in the New Testament. You know, the Old Testament is three times the length of the New Testament, right? I was talking to someone who, what's the difficult thing about you becoming a Christian? And she said, well, you know, before I was a Christian, I had all the rules. Everything was all spelled out for me. Now that I'm a Christian, and I ask Christians, should I do this? Should I not do this? They go, do whatever your conscience, you know. Should I read the Bible in the morning or in the evening? Do whatever works best for you, you know. How should you pray? The Bible doesn't tell us the position of prayer in contrast to other religions. You ever notice that? Doesn't tell you how many times you should bow or whether you should be on the floor or standing up. There is one position that's never mentioned in the Bible in prayer. It's a position that all of you are in right now. It's called sitting down. I don't think there's a place in the Bible where it mentions anybody sitting in a seat and praying. People are typically either standing up, so I'm more biblical than you are because I'm standing up right now, or they're prostrate on the ground, you know. Anyway, the point is that when we get to the New Testament, we don't see... It's not like God himself has changed his character at all. Not at all. But he is... the way in which he works among us does change as we go through the scripture. All right, these are good things. I'm going to have to call it quits here and let you guys have a break, and then we'll move on to the next book. But thank you for the interaction on all this.